Masters of Lying. Is the Cold War really over? Masters of Lying. Were the Universal Soldier into the night? The world is getting older. King Roswell, when they crash, the time warp is fast. Was it a real atomic crash?
Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I explore an emerging paradigm of expanded consciousness and a new perspective on history and where we're going into the future. Tonight's guest is someone who's written a book called The Secret History of Rock and Roll, Christopher Knowles. Christopher, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
I mean, the subtext is the mysterious roots of modern music. And in this book, you go through the mystery traditions, the ancient sects of initiation, and you make that association that somehow music and a sort of primal music is deeply embedded into our understanding of the sacred. Is that a fair way to sum up your book?
I can't think of a significant, you know, spiritual tradition that doesn't center around music, you know?
But
it seems they all do.
They do, but the thing that's interesting about rock and roll is it's not a sacred music in a way. Maybe on some level it is, but it's very much the music of the world. Or does it bridge from a kind of sacred domain into a profane domain?
Well, if you look at the roots of the music, you know, the modern variety, it goes right back to the Holiness Churches, the Pentecostal movement of the early 20th century. You know, this is where all the rock and rollers came from. I mean, Little Richard, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Aretha Franklin, Sam Cooke. I mean, you name it, up and down the line. These people all came from these churches, Pentecostal, Holiness, whatever you want to call it. The music was, music very much like rock and roll. I mean, all they eventually did was just change the lyrics. It was the same beats, same rhythm, same chord progressions, you name it. That old time gospel music is more rock and roll than anything on the radio today.
Right. So is there something basically holy or sacred about rock and roll music?
I think so.
Are you saying that about all music or particularly rock and roll?
Well, I think that music itself is, you know, an intensely spiritual phenomenon. You know, I mean, I'm not going to ascribe any sort of spiritual significance to all music. It certainly, you know, needs to be taken on a case-by-case basis. But I think that, music is one of the most powerful tools to spiritual realization. I mean, certainly if you look at all the major faith traditions, music is very, very central part of it. And as it was in the mystery traditions, I mean, music was, you know, very much part of the central appeal of the mysteries.
I mean, do you think it's something about the beat of rock and roll, how that backbeat, that drum that's so present is a sort of a reflection of the heartbeat? I mean, is there something like that going on?
Oh, sure. I think it goes back all the way. I mean, we're talking, I think this goes back to prehistory. You know, the drums were always such an important part of all indigenous and tribal cultures. You know, and the fast beat is the mirror of the accelerated heartbeat, you know, during sex or war or, you know, whatever sort of extreme peak experience you can name. You know, I think that it very much ties directly into that. Yeah, and this is why the church was so adamant about banning, you know, certain kind of drums, certain kind of rhythms, you know, for so long, because they understood the power of it. You know, it was something that needed to be crushed and suppressed, you know?
I mean, no, I agree. And for many people, I think a rock concert is similar to probably those wild initiations in the ancient temples of Greece and Rome and all over the world, where people would be opened up to new ways of thinking. And could that be why drugs have been so much connected with rock and roll?
Well, I think the drugs are really, you know, part, this goes back to the shamanic, you know, cultures. I think that, you know, everything sort of bridges away from shamanism, that shamanism is sort of the culture of all of this. Drugs were very much part of the ancient mysteries. And, you know, not necessarily, I mean, you can't have rock and roll without drugs. Again, going back to the Pentecostal, you know, I think that the music itself and the whole experience can very much simulate, you know, that kind of effect under the right circumstances. You know, it all depends. I don't think drugs are necessarily indispensable in this regard, but I think that they are very important as far as the alteration of your conscious state. And, you know, this is something that the ancients, you know, very, very much understood, you know, that the initiation and the eventual contact with these gods that were centered in these traditions, you know, definitely grew out of this very elaborate process that did start, you know, with the taking of these potions and whatnot.
Well, do you think the mysteries of Elysium, that greater mystery of the Greek tradition, like Wasserman says, was about some kind of a psychedelic elixir?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. Yeah, I think that this is something that, you know, was not understood for a very long time, because we couldn't quite be sure how to translate some of these terms that we used. But I think once we got you know, more of experience with certain indigenous cultures, certainly the Mesoamerican cultures, for sure, that, you know, we began to understand what exactly was going on here and what exactly, you know, the secret of the corn stalk, you know, corn being wheat, you know, which had to do with certain what was called LSA, which is a derivative or a variant, relative of LSD, that grew on certain you know, cereal crops. You know, it was a mold, it was a fungus that had psychedelic properties.
Right, and you think? I mean, yeah, I think I tend to think that the great mystery initiations did have a psychedelic component. But what is never talked about in the literature, at least that I've read, is that the people that were running those ceremonies somehow were able to hook the consciousness of those initiates and manipulate it and use it. And we don't really know how they did it and how they were able to maintain control of the mysteries. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, well, you know, as far as Eleusis is concerned, the Telestrion was run by two families, you know, over a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was very similar in some regards to, say, the Schubert family owning, you know, a chain of theaters, you know, where opera or film or rock concerts or Broadway plays or whatever. You know, it's very much the same kind of thing where, you know, certain families had ownership of these places and the recipes passed down through the years. We do have, from the Paris Codex, we have the Mithraic liturgy, you know, which talks about, you know, a mixture of herbs and certain what they call spices. You know, I'm sure if we were able to finesse these translations, I'm sure you would see that this was, you know, in reference to these psychedelic vegetables, plants.
But I'm just saying there must have been some amazing oral tradition from in these families, because none of that seems to have been written down, the way these people who controlled the ceremonies became the great shamans to lead masses of people through initiations for for probably what it lasted about 800 years, that main mystery in Greece, right?
Yeah, at least. You know, I don't necessarily think it needs to be an oral tradition. It could have been written down, but don't forget that there were these, you know, very strict rules against divulging the secrets of the mysteries.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I think that, you know, the people who were involved in the priesthoods could very well have had, you know, written records of all of this, but they were forbidden by law, actually, to divulge it.
But they, and so they were never divulged. So those records have disappeared over the last couple of thousand years, right?
Well, what happened is that, you know, they were kept secret for so many years. And then, of course, with the rise of Christianity, I'm sure all these records were destroyed. You know, especially since so many of these mystery cults bore such a startling resemblance to Christianity in so many ways. I think there would have been a great need to destroy evidence of the precursors, as it were, to Christianity.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. But it's amazing, though, reading the book and reading that kind of how close, like, you know, rock and roll is to Christianity, how close religion is to the profane, you know, that sacred and profane. There's this merging where there is, in a way, no separation, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if necessarily, you know, I think these distinctions are sort of artificial. You know, the Bible, it says, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, you know? We see traditional religious music is, you know, pretty vigorous stuff. I mean, look at the Sufis, you know, look at their musical traditions. You know, today, most of these megachurches, I mean, they're going in and singing hymns. You know, most of it is contemporary music with, you know, sort of a religious gloss. And even the hymns themselves, I mean, the hymns themselves were really, a lot of them were rewritten secular songs that were sort of calmed down a bit. You know, they were sort of sedated and given new religious lyrics. And you know, one of the great examples of this is Amazing Grace, which was a folk song that was rewritten to have, you know, these classic religious lyrics grafted onto it. And again, you know, going back to the holiness churches, and, you know, look at the gospel churches, you know, particularly in the African-American community. I mean, it's as rock and roll as it gets. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's also interesting what you mentioned earlier. I mean, the first these mysteries were to the gods, and now we've made sort of gods out of our rock and roll musicians. I mean, isn't that?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's something that was very much your concern among a lot of people in the 60s, is that, you know, particularly with the rise of, you know, the stadiums and the arenas. I mean, back in the 50s, they were playing, you know, just the usual circuit. They were playing, you know, concert halls and state fairs and these kind of venues. When it got to the point that the Beatles were playing Shea Stadium, I mean, it all of a sudden became a much different phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I mean, it sort of coincided with the, you know, the beginning of the decline of certainly mainstream Protestantism. You know, this is post-Vatican II as well. I think that traditional monotheism in America was beginning to lose its allure for a lot of people. And, you know, whenever a vacuum is created, something else will go into it. I think with rock and roll, I mean, I certainly, there isn't the same kind of energy and the same kind of enthusiasm and the same kind of excitement and the same kind of passion about rock and roll today. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that I sort of wanted to not necessarily rekindle that kind of passion, but to sort of remind people of it, to remind people that, you know, these musicians were once very, very important to us in our culture. They were godlike figures, and which is why I sort of group, you know, all these different acts into the same archetypal categories that we saw in the mystery traditions.
Right, and I think that's really interesting. I wonder why there aren't, like, these amazing superstars like there was in the 60s and even 70s? Did the culture change? Did music change? Did it get too big? I mean, there's still Mick Jagger, of course, you know.
But, well, you know, it's interesting because when I think of rock and roll, you know, when you know, you'll sort of proto rock, which I guess is sort of the early R&B and rockabilly acts of the late 50s and such. You know, but when you really think of rock and roll, I mean, so much of it, the real power and energy comes from the British invasion.
Yeah.
And I think there was a very interesting, you know, and you're talking a very small group of people in a very specific area of London in a specific time, you know, and this is where, you know, the Beatles, of course, came from Liverpool, but they eventually moved down to London and Rolling Stones and Bowie and, you know, on and on and on. I think it had a lot to do with the post-war era in Great Britain. You know, the fact that there was a tremendous amount of hardship and poverty. And there was also a tremendous amount of social repression. You know, Pink Floyd's The Wall, that film, is sort of a great document to this. And rock and roll was very much born out of this, you know, deprivation and frustration. I think that, you know, rock and roll really needs sort of to be, you know, grown in hard soil. And I think that the more comfortable people became, you know, the less alluring and the less needed and the less necessary the music became, I think.
But is it also just our generation? I mean, I guess we're sort of almost the same generation because maybe today people think that their music is the best. I don't know. I'm not really in touch with those, that younger generation that is listening to that music. I'm still listening to the music of the 60s and 70s, you know? So did we get frozen in time? Or was that truly on a worldwide kind of scale or some kind of scale, really great music of all time? I mean, it's hard to know.
Well, no, I grew up in the 70s and early 80s, and you know, that's sort of when I came of age. And you know, a lot of that music, I mean, kids are still attracted to that music. I think kids today understand that music and rock and roll and all these sort of things are not as central to the culture as they once were. And you know, if you look at who the top drawing acts are still today in the world, I mean, it looks like some, you know, a Billboard magazine from 1975. I mean, it's like, you know, the Eagles and Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen and Aerosmith and the Rolling Stones. I mean, these are the people who are still the big money earners. And you have a handful of acts, you know, maybe after that sort of mid-70s period. But, you know, the guys who are still out there, you know, I mean, these are people who are, a lot of them are, you know, nearing their 70s. It's amazing. You know, they can still get the job done.
Keith Richards, you know, his book is number one on the bestseller list as well, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because Mott the Hoople just did a reunion concert in London recently. And, you know, they were never really big in the States, but very popular in England. And it, you know, something just shocked me because I saw some of the video, and it was, you know, they were rocking and rolling. It was pretty much an exciting kind of show. And then somebody told me that Ian Hunter was like 72 years old, and I just it just boggled my mind. I couldn't process it that you know that this guy is that old. You know, the Stones are all in their late 60s. You know, McCartney, all these people. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, some of them, when you look at a lot of them, I mean, it's like, you know, rock and roll kind of keeps you spry, you know. I think that, you know, it's sort of a use it or lose it thing, you know, that which is not used is atrophied. And I think the fact that these guys are staying active and you know, there's sort of a rejuvenating power to the music.
To the music for the musicians, but I think you're saying in the book that rock and roll does something for the culture. Can you go into that a little more? Like it keeps us connected to something, specifically rock and roll, right?
Well, you know, I mean, rock and roll is such a, it's a very nebulous term in a lot of ways, because I mean, you're talking about a very broad range of sort of personality types involved in it. And, you know, people who, say, listen to mainstream arena rock are certainly a much different type of person than who would listen to, you know, college-oriented indie rock or listen to hardcore punk or, you know, whatever. I mean, there are so many subgenres and different subcultures and sub-subcultures, you know, attached to the music. It's really, really hard to make any kind of definitive sweeping statement or inclusive statement about rock and roll itself. I mean, it's like you really do have to start to get into these subcategories because, I mean, really what it is it's a shorthand term, you know, for post-war electric pop music, you know. I mean, it's other than that, it's not particularly meaningful or helpful because there is such a broad range of expression within that, you know.
Well, I do know what you mean, but it's also very, I mean, I think you can classify it in some way. I mean, it's different than the music of Frank Sinatra and those people that were from a different era and a different mindset. Something happened, I guess, with like people like Chuck Berry and Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and Elvis Presley, and they created something new that wasn't, it was in the churches, like you said, but they brought it out to the mass culture and people went wild, right? It ignited a spark that we're still reeling from in a way.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, it was a definitive break. And even within that, there's a definitive break from the 50s to the 60s. I mean, the 60s is sort of when things are even reset from what was going on in the 50s. Because in many, many ways, I mean, what's going on in the 50s is just sort of a synthesis of, you know, even pre-war music, you know, country swing, rhythm and blues, gospel, you know, all these kind of music forms are much older, you know. Even by the time the rock and roll, you know, what we think of rock and roll, Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, you know, Little Richard, Elvis, on and on and on, Buddy Holly. Yeah. I mean, these guys are playing, you know, riffs and rhythms that are pretty well established in the culture. Mm. You know, it's really the rise of the psychedelic groups and the British invasion where things are much, much different, that there's a major shift. You know, and things become more about lifestyle, things become more about, you know, in some sense, you know, big A art, you know, it's a much different kind of music. It's music that isn't just disposable 3-minute dance songs. You know, you start to see progressive rock, you know, and then certainly people like Elton John and Billy Joel, who are, you know, very, very highly trained musicians, expert. These guys who could be playing in symphony orchestras, but they choose to work in this idiom. Right. And it's a much different, it's a more potent, and I think in many ways, like, more resonant form of music rather than, you know, the simple blues scales and the simple 12-bar format, you know. It's got to be very repetitive in some way.
But I think that's also a really important point that it expanded beyond the music into a lifestyle that in a way took over the 60s and early 70s. I mean, the music was the key point behind a whole dropping out, turning on, tuning in culture that wanted to change the established ways, and the music drove it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no question about it. Certainly, you know, that's why sort of, you know, you point to this whole psychedelic era and then, you know, the Aquarian era, and there's this the whole counterculture of the late 60s. I mean, it really, people sort of forget how threatening it was seen to be and how angry, you know, it made the parent generation, you know, the kids who grew up in the late 60s and stuff. I mean, they were completely alienated from their parents. You know, there was a meaningful generation gap, mm-hmm. that you know, wasn't just a superficial thing, because the difference between the Grateful Dead and Elvis, I mean, Frank Sinatra, I mean, it's night and day, you know, it's a, just a completely, totally different set of expectations. And that sort of brought in, you know, there are so many things that sort of used that energy from psychedelic rock. You know, we start to see different lifestyle rights movements. You know, we see feminism, we see gay rights, we see the health food and exercise and those kind of movements. You know, so many things are part of this counterculture. You know, it's very much reevaluating, you know, how the world should be. You know, in some ways, we're sort of shifting back, you know, or at least some parts of the country are trying to shift back. I don't know if we can. But once once you've been off the farm, you can never truly go back, you know.
But you know, without the music, there wouldn't have been the counterculture. That's why I think that your book makes it such an important point, because that was the driving force. You know, can you picture the counterculture without rock and roll music?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the glue.
Yeah,
really. You know, and it was also the how do I put this? I mean, it really was the main attraction. You know, and it's funny because, you know, again, this sort of ties us back to the mystery cults. But the funny thing about the mystery cults, and this is something that people are almost completely unaware of, and why I wrote about it, is that this was very much a similar phenomenon. This is a similar phenomenon to the rise of the counterculture, in that the mystery cult sort of came out of this whole move towards individuality, towards personal expression, and that sort of necessitated a personal relationship to these God figures, where before that, you know, it was very much the state cults, this very cold and remote and harsh religious worldview. You know, these figures like Zeus and Jupiter are not very accommodating or comforting figures. Mm. And then you contrast that with these mystery figures like Dionysus and Isis, who are there to save you, who are there to deliver you, literally, you know, quite literally. And you'll read in the literature that that's how they saw what they were doing, is that it was to alleviate the fear and the terror of death. You know, that's a very interesting.
But do you think those cults may have existed before, let's say, those kind of, I would say, corporate cults or conservative cults of just worship the God and do what you're told? I mean, I think religion may have come out of the Dionysian kind of bacchanals or participatory sort of intensities that then the ruling class tried to suppress.
I think what happened is that it really came out of shamanism.
Yeah.
And, but shamanism, again, is this whole, you know, the shaman is the main event. I mean, he's the person who's going to, you know, talk to the gods for you. And that's where priestcraft sort of evolves out of. I do think that the mysteries were a new thing. I think the whole idea of this personal relationship with deity without the shaman, without the priest, was something new. I think it was an innovation, and it came out of an evolution, you know, in the attitudes of the culture.
But in the course of human history, do you see that as a kind of pattern where there's these sort of participatory religions and activities or sort of activism, I guess that's the word. And then it's like, then it goes the other side where there's this conservative part that takes over and suppresses it. I mean, I think Christianity was in a way in its beginning, this real activist type of movement that sort of went against the Roman Empire.
Well, I think Christianity was a mystery cult.
Uh-huh.
I think that it absolutely was. I think it was basically, the mystery cults were really starting to become not necessarily dominant, but were really beginning to overshadow the state cults, the temple cults. You know, the temples were really sort of the focal point of religion. You know, the Temple of Jerusalem, the Temple of Zeus, the Temple of Jupiter. And I think that Christianity, I mean, is very much up and down the line. I mean, I know, you know, you're not supposed to say this. It's okay. Not considered polite, but it very much is a mystery cult in every way. I mean, you know, yeah. Every aspect of primitive Christianity has a direct corresponding precedent in the mysteries.
And it needed to rise up because I think that's what I'm saying. It's a part of human history to start to go against the establishment just when things sort of get sedated and boring and things like Christianity or rock and roll or whatever the new thing that the human mind creates is there to stir the state up, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And I think it is a cyclical thing, but it's an interesting thing because it's not necessarily a linear progression, but it's sort of like, you know, things go in cycles, but every time the cycle ends, you know, you end a little bit further up the scale, you know, you end a little bit ahead of where you were before. And I think that, you know, right now.
Yeah. Where are we right now? That was my question.
Well, yeah. Where we are right now is that we're really in the doldrums, I think is the best way to put it. We are in a state right now where we've come to the end of a whole host of different cycles. And, you know, what we had in the late 60s was the whole, you know, the Jesus cult, you know, the Jesus freaks, as they were known. But that's very quickly was sort of co-opted by the, you know, the right-wing authoritarian Christian people. And they sort of, you know, use this energy to create this whole new personal kind of evangelical expression. But we're really sort of at the end of that, that is very much in collapse.
Well,
and at the same time, I mean, rock and roll is very much in a collapse because rock and roll was very much driven at starting in say the mid 70s that the record companies, instead of sort of chasing it, were sort of leading it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we began to see, you know, we saw some of this, you know, early on that, you know, they would create sort of ersatz people like Pat Boone, and in the 60s we saw the Monkees.
Right.
But it really got to the point, you know, and by the 80s it was over, that, you know, the music industry was dictating to the artists, you know, how things were going to go, what the trends were going to be, what the music was going to sound like, how people were going to look, what the fashions were going to be. And, you know, that sort of was very successful for a very long time. And still exists very much in pop and hip hop and in, you know, all these sort of commercial pop idioms right now. But even that's starting to collapse. I mean, everything is just sort of running out of gas. And where do you go next? You know, the way I think you go is that you go back into the past and you find out how people got out of this mess before and use that, you know, as an example, you know, use that as inspiration. And that is a time-tested and true method of reinventing culture is to go back and bring things back into the present.
Yeah, but none of that was ever so calculated, first of all, in the past. They seem to be like spontaneous movements. And the other thing I think that's contributing to this doldrum of the time is that Obama was sort of had the energy, this like last great messiah, And now we see the disappointment that, you know, you can find the great leader and it doesn't matter. He's just another poster person that you put up there and nothing changes. And all the energy that was behind this whole messy movement of Obama has fallen flat because he's just another guy in the White House trying to, just trying to keep his head above water. The disappointment with that has led to a whole collapse, I think, of a culture that is now.
I really hope that a counterculture would not be pinning its hopes and its future on a president, you know, on a politician. I was really disgusted with that whole Obama thing. I knew that it was going to, I didn't, you know, anticipate that it was going to, you know, run into the ditch so quickly. Right. But, you know, I thought it was just the height of stupidity for all these sort of rock stars and movie stars and, you know, these sort of people who set themselves up as youth leaders to hitch, you know, their horses to his wagon. I think that, it's insane, you know, because if you looked at who was funding him from the get-go, you know, it was all Wall Street, you know. I mean, his entire campaign, I think it was like $1 billion or something insane like that, from soup to nuts was all Wall Street money. So he's not going to go against them. He's not going to challenge them. He's not going to step on their toes. You know, and people should have figured that out from the get-go. I mean, I think that I hope that, you know, we will have a much more decentralized and not rely on these sort of empty suits to solve our problems for us. I think that's very disappointing.
Well, it was a sort of counterculture movement in a way that became, of course, mainstream somehow, but because he was a black president and all that, I mean, it gave people sort of permission to kind of rally around a new cause. And I don't think he's a bad person or even so aligned with those conservative forces. I don't think he's just has the power or the ability to go in a new direction, which is what what cultures that survive always need to do. They always need to build something new and original. And where is the counterculture now? What is the counterculture?
I mean, there are so many. It's so atomized and it's so spread out. Here's the deal. Is that the counterculture arises when you have a dominant culture. And, you know, say in the 60s, you had three or four, you know, you had the three networks and a couple independent stations in each city, right?
And so the Vietnam War, of course, you have to remember that.
Yeah, but, you had a limited amount of media outlets as far as the major media. Now, I mean, with the internet, it's exploding. I mean, there are so many different outlets, and even the what we saw is the bedrocks of our, you know, say the New York Times or Time Magazine or whatever. I mean, these people are all reeling. You know, they're all suffering because they can't compete. So I think that we shouldn't be looking for, you know, a big C counterculture. Because that can only exist when you have a coherent and dominant mainstream culture. And everything now is so specialized and atomized that, you know, things are going to move in a different direction. I think that, you know, one of the things, you know, is maybe it'll be sort of a resistance against this atomization. Like people will want to cohere again. People will want to come together and form something, you know, new that would require, you know, maybe to supplement their particular idiosyncratic interests. You know, I think that might be where you might be seeing, you know, the energy, you know, that the people want to move away from, you know, really what I think is a very alienating power that the internet can provide, you know, very you can become so specialized and that you'll just end up by yourself, you know?
Right. But in a way, the internet has become the dominant culture, and you know, there's no resisting it. I mean, you know, that is the force that is moving us now. It's become the church of all media. And where do you go to resist? You can't. You can't go stand on the street and get a gang together and bring down the internet. I mean, you wouldn't want to. It serves too many purposes. But there's a sort of a Borg-type feeling to this pervasive thing that has now taken over everybody's life, including my own, you know?
So yeah, no, I you know, listen, I mean, it could well be just part of our evolution, you know, that the internet is the global brain, you yeah. know? I mean, and it's not necessarily something that we can get away from. It just may be how we're evolving. What it becomes incumbent to do in that regard is, you know, how do you create a coherent culture, you know, within that atomizing potential? And I think that, you know, geography is really important. I think that maybe people beginning, you know, like we see a lot of people, bohemians and artist types, you know, selecting certain cities that have been in the decline, and sort of moving in and making them their own. I mean, Rochester, New York, Detroit, Portland, you know, that there's been this...
Brooklyn.
Yeah, Brooklyn certainly is the big success story. Yeah. I mean, that's going to be, you know, go without saying because of the power of New York and Manhattan.
Yeah.
But I think that that's going to be, you know, an important thing is getting back to, you know, some sense of a community within that brick and mortar reality that not everything needs to be digital, you know?
Right. No, I think that's a good point. I think the other part, where place I see counterculture is in these like splinter movements off the fringe, like UFOs, crop circles, people who believe in sort of the, which I'm a part of, they are very much a counterculture to the mainstream, but there's a momentum and maybe there will be some kind of government acknowledgement of that. But that's where I see now the tension in a sort of culture versus counterculture way.
Well, you know, that's been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know? The UFO thing, and you know, and just the fact that, I mean, this very strange, I mean, somebody had pointed out on my fan page on Facebook today that The Guardian, you know, this sort of left-wing paper in England, you know, printed an article, you know, where the Royal Society of England is saying that people really need to start preparing themselves for alien contact, you know, and that to me is like, if you had told me 20 years ago that I was going to see that, I would have laughed in your face. I mean, you know, you're talking about the guardians of, you know, no pun intended, but the guardians, you know, of consensus reality being, you know, the Royal Society and the Vatican, and both of them are very much on the forefront of this issue. So, I mean, we, you know, we'll certainly see. But I think that those cultures that you're referring to, you know, have been around it for at least, you know, I guess since, you know, the Kenneth Arnold and Roswell episodes, right?
Well, it has been, but because of the internet, there is gaining a coherence and a communication and the counterculture now is sort of a new paradigm that accepts things like that and reincarnation and all that kind of what I call, which is sort of what my show New Realities is about, this whole divergent opinion to the established belief system. A new worldview is what I feel the counterculture is now.
Well, you know, it's weird because it's sort of a combination of a grab bag of different ideas that, you know, in UFOs are definitely part of it. I'm not sure that it could be considered a definitive counterculture yet, but it's definitely, you know, a major, I guess, microculture as you know, as it were.
Well, it depends if you're in it. I'm in it. I live it. You know, I talk about it all the time. Like, you know, when is the government going to let us know our secrets? Or did you see the latest crop circle? Or
well, yeah, I mean, I cover a lot of that stuff on my blog.
Yeah,
my opinion is that, you know, the government has no reason to, you know, divulge, you know, truth. I mean, there might be some sort of form of disclosure, but I you know, because the problem is that once you are dealing with, you know, a superior technology and a superior civilization, you know, the government becomes surplus at that point in time. And it's funny, too, because, you know, rock and roll and UFOs sort of came up at the same time, right? And there's always been a very interesting sort of connection between the two. And, you know, one of the things that I wrote about on the blog a couple of years ago is how one of the mystery cults, the Mithraic cults, you know, you have this sort of liturgy that's, you know, sounds like a contact narrative. I mean, it's very much, you know, being taken up in a flying disc and you know, shown the universe and all these sort of things. So, you know, things are maybe more connected than we might think, you know?
Wow. No, I believe the whole – I think they are here. I think the big problem is sort of what Timothy Leary sort of touched upon, is that we are not supposed to think differently than the mainstream culture. And that was the whole thing with LSD and psychedelics. It wasn't that they were bad for you. It's that you thought about reality differently. And when you acknowledge the fact that there are UFOs or whatever you want to call them, it means your version of reality does not match the mainstream. And that's what I'm calling countercultural here, you know?
No, I definitely do agree with you.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's interesting because, you know, what we sort of call, you know, for lack of a better term, what people might call New Age is very diffuse and scattered. But there are a lot of people who very quietly and very sort of sub rosa do not think the same way as their parents. I'm not sure.
Exactly.
I'm not sure.
I just published a paper on ESP, you know, psychic phenomena, in the New York Times. So, you know, there's that change. Maybe it's sort of like Christianity. Maybe it's a cult that's taking over or something.
Well, you know, it's a funny parallel you draw there, because really Christianity was not a singular phenomenon. You're talking about a group of cults, all with radically different interpretations of their faith. You know, everything from the temple, you know, the Jerusalem cults, which were really just Messianic Judaism, to Gnostic cults that were very much maybe Neoplatonist or involved in mystery cults. You know, there was this huge, huge diversity, this heterodoxy of views. And it wasn't until the Roman Empire decided that, you know, it was convenient, you know, to create a one world religion that everyone would sort of fall under, that we started to see, you know, this codification, you know, and it was something that the Roman emperors had to spend a good century hammering out, you know, the killing thousands and thousands of priests who taught a different Christianity than what the church was preaching.
Well,
you know, so maybe in some ways that's an interesting parallel, because it was this sort of diffuse and almost confused culture, you know, that the great quote by Hadrian, where he said that, you know, Christians in Alexandria weren't sure whether they were supposed to pray to Christ or to Serapis, you know, I mean, because the figures were so similar. You know, what you're describing might be sort of that, almost that law of eternal return, that, you know, a scattered and maybe incoherent looking group of counterculturers, with plural, will start to cohere into something new and definitive.
Well, that's why I think what's is sort of happening, and maybe it takes 200, 300 years to see what's being germinated right now. But it is interesting that those Christian cults eventually did take over the great Roman Empire, and in whatever form that it did, and then codified the world for another 1,000 years until it splintered again. But we're now in some very beginning process, it seems like, of something new emerging.
Yeah, I agree with you. So, that's, you know, one of the reasons why I work so hard on my blog, because, you know, a lot of the ideas that you're discussing, and they do tie into the book, you know, the secret history of rock and roll is sort of very much part of this whole continuum that I look at. But I very much agree with you. I think it's going to take a lot less time than 300 years, I'll tell you that much. I mean, I'd be surprised if it took 30, to be honest with you.
Well, this whole 2012 thing, I mean, another kind of modern myth, but something is at least on people's minds. And I think the only major point about 2012 is it orientates us to a galactic awareness. We're no longer Earth-centric or even solar-centric. We're now opened up to something much bigger. And this is where I feel the UFO stuff comes in and all that, you know, potential ET interaction.
There's no question about it. And believe me, I mean, whether or not they acknowledge it, I mean, you know, the powers that be are very much concerned about this. I mean, look at how they're putting all this hardware into space and everything you read now. I mean, space stories and, you know, these telescope stories and UFO stories and all this stuff, all this cosmic kind of junk, as it were, is in the news all the time. I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
No, it's exciting. So what do you think in 30 years the culture will look like? Any, like, ideas, projections?
I think there are a lot of variables at work here. I mean, I think that if America continues to decline, things, you know, are very uncertain. I think we could sort of see you know, a collapse of globalism and sort of a return to nationalism and localism. You know, it all depends. I mean, I think we're sort of looking at a lot of major obstacles, but those major obstacles might be the catalysts for a major paradigm shift. You know, I mean, we tend to overlook the fact that our belief systems are very much tied to our social conditions, to our environmental conditions. You know what I mean? When you have a full belly, you see the world a lot differently than if you're hungry.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then on and on and on, you know, it all, you know, the same principle extends to so many different things. What we are dealing with in our condition and our environment is going to determine, you know, what we see the world and how we describe the world. I think that there's no question in anybody's mind that things are undergoing major changes. You know, whether or not that will work out in a beneficial way, I think is really incumbent on every person out there. You know, I think that this is sort of a game that everybody has a part in, you know, no matter how small it may be.
Do you think rock and roll will survive?
Oh, I don't think it'll be, you know, what we recognize. I mean, I hope it evolves. It's sort of been, you know, one of the reasons why it hasn't been doing too much in the culture at large is that it's sort of been stuck in this neutral. I would really like to see the music evolve. I'd like to see a new generation of artists come in and really start to bring some of the excitement back into it. I think that, you know, there are a lot of things that people can rediscover. You know, there are a lot of great artists just in the classic rock period that never got played on the radio or you know, are unknown. I've been listening to the psychedelic rock station on the internet, and I just the music on that just blows me away, and I'm always like going, I've never heard of this band, and this is like one of the coolest songs I've ever heard.
Really?
Like, oh yeah, yeah. There's so much out there to discover. There's so many great musicians. A whole host of really obscure British and American. And maybe Canadian psychedelic rock bands that never got the kind of breaks that maybe like the Jefferson Airplane or the Grateful Dead got, but were really great. I can't even think of the names right now. There's so many of them. But that's the internet has a positive effect that it gives you the tools to sort of rediscover what was lost, because in the old days, if it wasn't played on the radio, you didn't necessarily have access to it.
Right. But you think maybe also it was such a high cultural point, the 60s, 70s of Renaissance, that those songs were so classical in a way. Is it possible to write songs today? I mean, of course it is, but it doesn't seem like it's happening on the level of...
It is happening. You know, it is. There are great songs out there. It's just there isn't that focus.
Yeah.
You know, things, again, are very scattered and diffused, but there is a lot of great music out there. You just really have to work at finding it. But music, the muses, that power of music is alive and well. Unfortunately, the problem is that the record industry wants to dumb everything. Hello?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm still here.
Okay. The record industry really wants to dumb everything down and make everything lowest common denominator. Which is why we see all this garbage pop and hip hop out there now, stuff that has really no musical content at all.
Yeah.
But it's like candy. It's junk. But it has no nutritional value. But there is a lot of great music out there, and I'm hoping that people will begin to appreciate it more in the near future.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I appreciate this conversation and your book. And what's your blog?
My blog is called The Secret Sun, and it's secretsun.blogspot.com.
And what does that mean, The Secret Sun, to you?
To me, well, one of it is we talk a lot on the blog about all this serious symbolism, we sort of speculate what the secret sun might be, and maybe it's Nibiru or it's Sirius or the Pleiades or you name it. It's just sort of the whole idea is, what is not being said, what has been lost, what needs to be rediscovered.
All right. Well, I do have to wrap it up here. Thank you, Christopher. I've been talking to Christopher Knowles, his book, The Secret History of Rock and Roll, The Mysterious Roots of Modern Music. It's a great overview of our history, our cultural history, and where we are now. Thanks for being here with me.
My pleasure.
Okay, I'm going to end with one of those classic rock and roll songs. This Neil Young, After the Gold Rush.
Good one.
Yeah, yeah. He's one of the classic figures of our culture. Okay. Talk to you soon, Christopher. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Check my website, newrealities.com, and also the BBS archives, where all this series of shows from New Realities is posted. Also, you can check for some of these postings on newrealities.com. Thanks for listening, and this is Neil Young, After the Gold Rush.